Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking soil compaction. Our spotlight will take a look at the National Weather Service no longer issuing wind chill warnings and advisories. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of the wind chill. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Well, I wish I could say, and to an extent, we're getting cooler. It's getting there, but today is still looking like potential of near 80 degree weather. So it doesn't feel like almost mid-October.
No.
Out there. At night, it kind of does. I mean, it gets cooler at night. We've had some cool mornings, but still getting the heat during the day. But next week, we may actually get ourselves some legit frost.
Under 30
yep.
For like Tuesday night.
So killing frost is coming.
Potentially killing frost, yeah.
Especially if you're probably north.
Yeah. Yeah, he. Yeah, even the far north, I think they got a little bit of frost.
A little bit.
Beginning of this last week. So they may be in for the hard stuff this weekend.
This is the most fun time of year, though, isn't it? Soybean harvest, corn grain harvest, football.
Yeah. I mean, you get to see the fruits of your labor all summer, right?
Like, right.
Hopefully they're good fruits, not poor.
This year's hard because...
Yeah, the fruits have been variable.
The labor was very intensive, and the fruits may be less fruity. They're just not as good this year.
Yeah, they're smaller fruit.
They're variable fruits. Seems like some have very good fruits, depending on the field. And
shrinkflated fruits.
Yes, that is true.
It's the same package size, but smaller. Yeah,
ratio of labor to fruits maybe not as good this year.
True.
Yes. I was driving through an area yesterday with heavy clay, and they left some insurance rows, corn silage, and it was just amazing the variability of the fruit in that area, like 8 foot tall corn and 2 foot tall corn in the same field, and just a roller coaster. Like if that was going to be a carny ride, that would be a perfect
it would be a
perfect field. And I'm sure you guys have walked those all summer to know that. But
oh yeah,
just think if you're an adjuster this year, how hard that is.
Yeah.
Where do you, you know? I know that's why they leave those rows so they can see that and adjust for that. But it would be hard to kind of make sure you're being as accurate as you can be.
Right. Because even across the field, like, depending how the rows go, you could get, like, you'd have to be, and not that anyone would try to cheat the system or anything, but, I mean, you could get either mostly short rows or mostly tall rows, depending what rows you pick. So you kind of got to be a little bit more mindful of how you pick those rows.
It's an art, right?
Sure. Even them adjusting when I've ever watched them too, and you got to weigh the cobs, and there's protocols to it to try to make it as accurate as possibly can, but it's very hard still to be accurate. It just is. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, it's like you said, football season too. And that's been kind of up and down for our Green Bay Packers, at least. They had a little bit of iffiness there for the first bit of the go-around, but pulled off a win this last week. So,
win's a win.
Win's a win.
Take it.
Win's a win.
And even more local, the Seymour team's been doing really good this year.
Did they win on Thursday night, do you know?
I don't know if they won last night or not.
Because they...
It was New London.
It's going to be a clash of Titans when they got like undefeated Winneconnie so far, but they have to play yet, so they may not be undefeated, but
right.
Seymour plays in the last game. And then a lot of fun coming up is you have football playoffs coming up. So, Bill, even your Wrightstown team is doing really well this year, too.
They lost to the dreaded Freedom.
Oh, no.
Irish last week. They beat Denmark last night, but
were they at Freedom or were they at?
It was home. It was a good game.
42-8, Seymour won last night.
There you go.
Nice.
They are 7-1 on the season, and yes, we'll be up against Winneconne next week.
Can you hear the games from your house, Matt? Like very
last night, in particular, because it was senior night, so you could hear announcing all the seniors.
Okay,
could hear that. Well, I went for a walk after dinner, and I usually walk up towards the park, which is just behind the football stadium. And with all the trees gone in the park now,
when they took down all the ash trees gone,
like there's no buffer. So yeah, it's almost like kind of right between the school and the fairgrounds. So between the races and the football games now, it's like I can hear
hear them all.
You're kind of right in the middle of everything there.
Yeah.
Have you gone back to a game? We went to homecoming. It was the first time I've been at a high school game in like 20 years since being in high school.
Sure.
And it was cool because it was a lot the same.
Yeah.
It was cool. It was fun to see the band.
You're just older.
Yeah. It was weird sitting. Well, we sat kind of by the opposing fans because the other side was pretty full.
Wow.
That was kind of fun.
Wow. Go to homecoming and then sit.
Well, we were just on the end of.
There was no room to stand by your home team crowd.
No, there wasn't. They were all. It was packed.
Wow,
it's a packed house.
Homecoming is probably like if you're just gonna go to one game. Like I realize that's the point of homecoming,
right?
But if you're gonna go to one game, don't go to homecoming because it's the
busiest. Right.
It's the busiest game.
Yeah, it was. At halftime, they had like. Picked random students to like play like a they just did like at like what they do at halftime at a Packer game where they just
throw a football or whatever
it. Just hit bomb it but the one guy that they had bombing it he should be on the team. He was chucking them so I was like even the opposing teams like, man, we'd take that guy as our quarterback, what the heck. So yeah, it was
that's funny.
It was cool to see. And yeah, and they're kind of lining up neat. They got one set of plays where they'll put that the center can, so there's two guys in shotgun and the center can snap it to like either guy.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't, yeah, they didn't run it that often, but the times they did, I'm like, oh, that's, it's neat to see some newer.
That's what the team was doing, not this halftime thing.
No, right. That's what the team was doing. Sorry.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Is Wrightstown Institute that? I don't even know what that's called.
No.
No.
No, they're actually.
Is it a variation on the wishbone? Like,
yeah. Yeah, because Wrightstown was like run the whole.
Yeah,
game.
They're like probably 30% pass now. So ooh, that's like
that's huge.
That's big time.
Yeah,
yeah.
But they'll take that kid you saw
right
at the
right.
The football game too, if he's got an arm. All right, you guys ready to get into our discussion for today?
Ready.
So, soil compaction. We never see that. That's pretty rare, right? No, wait. No, it's all the time.
It's all the time.
It's everywhere. Everywhere, everything all at once. It's definitely an issue that we deal with a lot in different areas, and even when you try to fix it, a lot of times you're just moving compaction, you're not necessarily getting rid of it, or at least in, you know, getting rid of it in the short term. So it can be hard thing to deal with and hard thing to test for, especially or as dry as we are now. Because dry soils getting tight could give you the impression that you have compaction in areas that maybe you don't really have compaction. So I think that's probably the point of the discussion, right, Bill?
Well, and I think this year, because we had, like, we were so dry early, then we got so wet in May and June, and then we've kind of tapered off, and now we're really dry again. I think we've all saw that as the summer has gone on, the top, especially the tillage layer, has really compacted itself, right? All that air and pore space is gone with the summer rains, and then it kind of just collapsed. And I've got a lot of guys asking this year about, should I get the deep till out? You know, it's dry. We can do it. And now it's almost to the point where it's too dry. I had a guy yesterday I was talking to, and I was like, how deep are you going? And he's like, I'm going as deep as I can until the front end of my tractor comes off the ground. I'm like, Yeah, that makes sense because of how dry it is. And it worked out that it was about, I had done some probing and it was just, he was getting below it. So that was good. But I think it's really hard to know when to test because the conditions are never perfect to do it. To actually, not so much to do the tillage part of it, but to actually do the probing of it because you're not as strong as what the tractor is to get that machine in the ground. So it's like, when is the best time to do it? And if it's too wet, well, then you're just going to go through like butter and you're really not going to feel nothing. You're probably best to do it in the summertime when there's adequate moisture.
It's the Goldilocks paradox of compaction. It's like, totally got to be just right to probably get the best results. But well, I mean, we've done it. I did some before it got as dry as it is now. And it was okay.
And you broke your probe.
I broke the probe. Yeah. And you broke your not like unusable broken, no. But still, it was just
But that is what the frustrating part about the testing is it's hard by the time you can test it well in the fall, like at harvest, it's not the best time to test
right
when you want to test. At harvest, some harvests are okay, but it's like this year, it just didn't, you know, it's too dry. Some spots it kind of can work. Well, then you know your soil is fairly mellow. What a lot of the research says is the best time is in the spring, but kind of right at, you don't want it too wet in the spring. You want it kind of like later spring, early summer.
Sure.
And that makes sense. But at that time too, that's like not the time you can do much to fix it.
When it's right, it's probably time to plant.
So, right. So you're more doing it to kind of predict, okay, this fall, I know this layer will probably still be here. Yep. We probably should.
You're not doing nothing about the crop that you're going to plant at that point. You're doing it for future you.
But what's hard is this year when I did it this spring, actually stuff was pretty deep. I mean, at planting it when it got really wet, it was not. But that kind of early plant stuff, right when it was still adequate, we had very little compaction. Or last year we had a pretty good fall to alleviate any compaction with tillage that we had to. And like you say, but all the compaction we have this year happened in June when it just didn't stop raining.
Yeah. And
maybe some of that when you had to mud a little bit of corn in or do something to get your crop in. So, yeah, the when do you test is hard because there isn't necessarily a really, really good time. So it's kind of one of those things you got to test whenever you possibly – whenever the soil is adequate or maybe when you are doing the tillage and you know it's not perfect, but you can at least kind of adjust your tillage around it and know you're trying to get down through it.
What kind of probe do you use? Do you buy the fancy penetrometer or?
I used to use just the regular soil probe. Then I went to kind of the sawed-off soil probe, and I do have a penetrometer now in my truck. The downside with the penetrometer is the dial is a like a water-based dial, so if you leave it like in the winter, it'll freeze and crack.
Sure.
So you got to try to watch that of like, okay, I got to throw this in my garage for the winter or whenever. But I do use it. What's hard is it's hard to walk around in the field with, and it's hard to, like, even while you're soil sampling, it doesn't go along with you that well or easily. So a lot of times it is one of those tools that it's not just easy to kind of have with you. It's just usually in the truck, and then you're like, oh, okay, I'm going to go grab that and, you know, probe some with it. But what I would say, it doesn't really, the dial on it, I it's helpful, but at the same time,
it's still a feel.
Right, it's 100% feel, because a lot of times on that dial, almost anything you push through shows it's too compacted.
Right. A lot of times, just the soil surface, just to get through that sometimes can register as compacted.
It's compacted. So, I mean, you really got to be, you got to kind of know, too, of the feel of it, of not just whatever this machine says it's too compacted, but especially in the fall. In that early summer, late spring timing, if you did it and the soil moisture was like perfect, I bet you could use that dial, but it's got to be like perfect for that.
The dial would go to red right now, like every
field it does. Yeah, it's just to red. So then it becomes to a feel of where is the layer, how deep.
Can you get through it?
Right.
Is it an inch? Is it three?
Right.
Yeah.
Which is helpful, that part of it too. The depth is probably just as important as is there. No, two things you want to know. Is there a compaction layer there or not? What is the depth?
Yeah.
Right.
because then we know how to adjust tillage. And
you can do
to,
that with any.
Right. So, yeah, what do you use, Bill?
I just use a sawed-off soil probe.
Yeah.
It's about two and a half foot long. It's not heavy. It's not top-heavy like that penetrometer is. You can throw it in the back of the four-wheeler.
It doesn't free. Doesn't the dial won't break?
Yeah.
And
it's sturdy.
It goes along with you, which is nice because I've had that problem where you know this is a 3 foot long thing that just is
yeah.
It just doesn't.
And it's not super comfortable. Like you're all constantly bending over because
right,
it's
it'd
shorter.
Be shorter.
Where yours is a little taller, but you get the leverage for sure because you're lower. You get good leverage. It's not like you're trying to push something that's you know taller. That's the leverage is harder, but it works. And to me, it's like you said, Todd, it's all a feel thing. And like, okay, there's the layer. And a lot of times it's between that 8 and 12 inches anyway. So you don't need to go deeper than that.
I would agree with you on that. And this year even I'm seeing a lot at like 6 inches, like very shallow, like 4 to 6 where guys talk about getting a deep ripper out, and you may not need the deep ripper. You may just need a chisel plow, actually.
And I've had plenty of spots where it's like I only went down an inch. It's like, okay, that's just surface. That's surface compaction from the rain we had this summer. That's not real soil compaction where you made a layer for the most part, right? I mean, it's just like you can't even push it in the ground. Well, that's just the soil's too hard, and you got to pick a different day.
Yeah. No, and I've been using the pretty much a non-fancy one, too. It's from a soil health kit, so it's a little bit...
That one's got a beefy handle.
Yeah, the handles are kind of heavy-duty.
That handle is... heavy-duty is an understatement. The handle's like... it's just heavy.
But
and it works slick, though. That's a nice... I've used that one. One thing I do like about that one is the tip on it. I feel is the right because it's kind of like a it's a cone.
It's a cone, yeah.
And I think it's the half inch kind of tip cone, and I like that. Some of these that you buy, you can get different tips where you got like one for softer soil, a bigger tip. But I've never even used that big tip ever.
They say for tillage soil, you're supposed to use the bigger tip as opposed to
like a
no-till situation. Yeah, because I had a chance to use a really fancy probe this year, which is the one that broke and. I mean, it's cool and all. It's got a digital readout, and it tells you the whole, like, the PSI and how deep you are. So it gives you all that, and you could, if you wanted to, you could hook a GPS up to it and, like, GPS it and stuff. But, yeah, as dry as things were getting and everything, it's still, it's, the fancy ones are nice, but, like, Todd's dial freezing or this one, you know, getting stuck in the ground, when you really want to use it, you can't use it unless the conditions are right. So sometimes the simpler solution is the better one.
How does it sense the depth on that?
Sonar. So it's got like a...
Oh, like in the top part.
Top, yeah, in the handle.
That's
it's
cool.
It's got a thing that it
bounces
can tell
the ground
as you're going.
That's really
deeper.
Cool.
Yeah. No, like I said, it was fancy, but yeah. I definitely couldn't use it now, even if it was not broken. Like, well,
is it fixable?
It's not broken, but like it still works. It's just it doesn't. It's the little plastic ring thing that busted. I would imagine it's fixable. I'm gonna find out, but it's just one of those things where, like, you use this and you're thinking, oh yeah, this is gonna be great, and then it gets caught or whatever, and didn't seem all that well manufactured for how like compared to. A broken soil probe isn't going to just, the handle isn't going to pop off
right
in the soil. Right. Or the heavy-duty soil health kit one isn't going to break in the soil.
No, I do think one of the problems with compaction is there is no easy button at all.
Right.
Starting with the testing for it. I mean, like we just talked, is these fancy testers, they're cool and all, but they don't
they're
work.
Very limited.
On, yeah. They don't work unless the conditions are perfect. And then... kind of our very crude testers are so crude that I've even had farmers just, you know, it's
why do you just have a
right yeah. Like that don't tell you nothing, and it tells you enough.
Right.
So
you're killing a vampire, you got a hammer and a stake, what are you doing?
Yeah. Actually, that would work perfect for Halloween coming up.
Yeah,
you just gotta carry it around, and yeah,
Got to get a wood compaction probe.
Well, even the ones like what university uses, and some of those are really neat, where it's kind of hooked to a computer and it kind of robotically pushes down in, and yeah, that would be really slick. And but those are hard, like they're just not a commercially available thing either as well. And to do it, I always thought you'd have something
thousands of dollars
right.
that you'd spend on a setup like that. And
it's thought we'd,
I'm sure it's got its issues too.
pH detector we had on the four wheeler.
Do I remember the pH? Yes, Todd.
So that was, Bill, you remember that?
Oh, that was machine? A POS.
Yeah. It was a mistake, but I always, like, that basically was a mounted on the back of a four-wheeler, and then you'd push it down in the soil, and then it would open the soil up and go put a pH probe down, like, 3 inches, and you could do a whole bunch of those, and it was supposed to work great. But remember how it had to, like, open up the soil to get, like, down in there?
Yeah, so basically it had, just, like, a shoe on the bottom that you would stick in the ground, and then it would have, when the door opened, it was supposed to kind of push the soil out of the way, and then you'd put the, like, so you'd do that first, and then you put the probe in, and then you'd wait, like, 30 seconds or whatever it was. There was a little light on it.
That it would tell you when it's stable.
Tell you when it was done. And then
it'd rinse it off.
Pick it up and it would rinse off. But yeah, never rinsed off right. The door would get stuck.
So I just remember that the soil had to be like the most perfect conditions.
Yeah, in the sands, it was fine.
Sand, it worked, right? Which is where you kind of...
But like right now, way in heck we'd be able to use it.
And so, like 35 degrees, the little tubes would freeze.
Oh, yeah.
If it was too cold, the water wash thing wouldn't go. Yeah.
Was that up in the barn when the tornado came through?
Oh, yeah.
Did we lose it in the tornado?
I believe I recycled it.
Yeah, I think it went to the recycling.
Think I parted. Like, we just were like, I bet you we got I think it was like $6,000 for that dumb thing.
It was a lot.
And we probably broke even on it, I think was the goal. And then I didn't want to see it anymore because I was so mad about it. Because
you were mad about it. You were the one running
No, Matt had to run it. Well, and Matt even modified it with like, remember how you made it where you'd open that chamber by hand kind of because of.
Right, because it would get stuck all the time and it would never open right.
It was a.
Because you would get dirt stuck in there. And if you. I basically just put a bolt on it and pull the door open, and then it would...
I remember seeing your modification, like, what are you doing? And then I'd watch you doing, like, okay, yeah, that is better, because this was... Anyway, two things about that. One, that's what this reminds me of, is we get these fancy things to try to do something sort of simple, and it doesn't help us. Like, that machine was not... There's a reason they're not sold anymore. I mean,
right. And they did, they made changes to it and basically made it an on the go system where you didn't have to even futz with it, really. It was the next generation of it, it just ran kind of by itself.
So that, and I always thought we would get like a compaction tester on a four wheeler, on an implement, even in some way. You know, it's crazy to me of like all the mapping we do have and, you know, why don't we have a way to map it yet? So hopefully sooner
even
or later
on like a corn planter, right?
We're
going through. We got smart firmers.
We got smart sensors. We got all this stuff, and yet that part of it is just hard to detect. And maybe they'll use ground penetrating radar or something to check it. But it does seem there. It's what's hard with compaction is there's different variabilities of it, and it's not that you can't get through the layer either. It's just that it's more dense. So I think that's what's sort of tricky with having a true sensor. But
well, I think for all the reasons we've talked about, how it's hard to know the right time or to get all the tools to work is why there isn't a simple solution because, when you're lacking moisture right now, when it's dry, you might get a false sense of density because those pores are empty. And, you know, the space seems like it's compacted versus if water got into the system, maybe it wouldn't look the same. But, yeah. So when you fix it, we've talked about, tillage being really the option to fix it. Cover crops would be another option if it's loose enough. I mean, you're not going to send a root that's... Part of the problem with compaction, why we see issues with compaction, is the roots can't get through.
Yeah.
But if you can break it up and then get roots in there right away, that can keep it from reforming, which is kind of a a solution that might work better than just kind of breaking it up and then you go through freeze thaw, you'd run it over again and basically just create that compaction layer the next year.
And I'm hopeful that we've got to a point now where we're using these inline rippers that are very narrow, that we just want to fracture that soil, take out the compaction, and we don't want to explode the surface of the soil. We're not using that big DMI deep ripper anymore. We're just blowing everything up. You know, we just want to get that layer out, keep that soil structure in place, and move on from there. So I hope that's to the point where we are now, and most guys I'm seeing are doing it. Even if you got to plant your cover crops and then do it later because you have so much to do, or, you know, kind of do your normal farming practices and then kind of get that deep ripping done when you can. And even if it's just, I think one thing that I'm noticing more as time goes on, especially as the farm equipment gets bigger, is don't forget about those harvest roads that you make, especially in corn silage. Like, you know, university is drilling into us that let's just not drive willy-nilly throughout the field with our semis. Let's go to a spot and then drive out the field.
Right. Put all your compaction in one spot where you know it's going to be versus...
Yeah. Just hammer one spot and then come back later and let's fix that one spot with the deep tillage, with the inline ripping, your headlands, and those harvest roads. I'm going to call them harvest roads. I don't know what's a better...
Yeah, lane, term, road. Lane.
So just fix those. And that should be every field. Like every year, every field, we should be thinking about where in the headlands and these harvest lanes or roads, let's fix those for sure.
Well, I think, too, even using those, you're still going to have tracks like the... I'm trying to think of the good way to say this. The with the rows compaction, I think, is always... probably something that we know because of how we're trafficking.
Right.
It's the when guys cut across.
Yeah.
And make those lanes that aren't like a straight line because they're not following rows. And then you get these weird like diagonals and stuff that you see the next year in
it's
the
like
crop.
They peel off from the chopper, right?
Right.
You got to get away from the chopper and get to that road somehow. And you do see that sometimes.
Yeah. Instead of driving to the end and going through the headland or whatever, they'll just cut across. And those are the ones that are harder to find sometimes.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think definitely having a somewhat of a plan and hopefully drivers that will pay attention to the plan would make things easier.
Couple of rules of thumb when you are doing subsoiling is I think you got to watch that your subsoil, we just talked about that, but subsoiler is not bringing up some less fertile clay, a different layer of soil. You know, that's why the inline ripping where you're just fracturing that soil, you're not disturbing it, is the best way to go. You potentially could have more stones that you're going to move around, especially if you're in a stony area. And then horsepower, right?
Yeah.
I mentioned that before about a guy picking up the nose of his tractor, but 40 to 50 horsepower per shank. So you need some, you know, you got a 4 or 5 shank, you need some ponies there to, go. And it's always good to leave a couple strips where you don't treat just to kind of see like, oh, hey, we did make a difference here.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. So yeah, if you're looking for ideas on soil compaction, probably not the ideal time to go out and check for it now, but there never really is an ideal time. So sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not. Hopefully if we get some moisture yet this fall, it'll make things a little bit easier. Just getting a soil probe in the ground right now can be pretty difficult, let alone a compaction probe. So if you think you have compaction, it's always a good idea to kind of try to determine where it is and if you can and have the option to do some tillage to fix it, that now would be probably a good time to try. So now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So this year we may actually have a winter, unlike last year where we had like 2 cold weeks and nothing else that really indicated winter weather. But you may notice a difference this winter with how your weatherman or weather app addresses things like the wind chill. So the National Weather Service announced it will no longer be issuing public-facing wind chill warnings, watches, and advisories beginning this winter. Wind chill terms have been retired to clear up confusion surrounding weather warnings for the public, according to Milwaukee Sullivan National Weather Service Office meteorologist Benjamin Shepard. Previously, wind chill advisories and extreme cold advisories were issued separately, with the former based on the wind chill calculation, which essentially considers both air temp and how cold it feels, and the latter based on air temp alone. So advisories will be issued, or so now North National Weather Service will only issue cold weather advisories, extreme cold watches, and extreme cold warnings, using wind chill temperatures in-house to help determine when to issue those particular things. So a cold weather advisory will be a wind chill or temperature of negative 20 degrees Fahrenheit in the next 12 to 24 hours. Extreme cold watch will be wind chill or temperature of negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit, possible within the next 24 to 72 hours. And an extreme cold warning will be wind chill or temperature of negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit is imminent for the next 12 to 36 hours. So new guidelines are based on research indicating both wind chill and extreme cold without wind are equally impactful and equally dangerous and require similar precautions. So there you go. No more wind chill warnings.
Were we that dumb that we didn't understand that you don't necessarily need a lot of, like, then it's just really cold. Yeah. Like,
right.
That negative 30 is kind of the breaking point there, isn't it? It seems like that's...
Yep, yeah.
School starts to really negative cancel. Well,
35, right? Here. I think negative 35.
Yeah. Well, okay.
If they get it in the south, then it's like, ooh, if it's negative anything, then it's they cancel degrees. School. But, which is, I mean, when you think about it, 32 degrees is freezing. So anything under 32 is, you know, cold.
Yeah.
Cold. And when you get negative... In the Fahrenheit system, you're
really cold. Yeah,
negative 20 is 50 degrees below freezing.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
chilly.
I was looking up if they retired any other weather terms, and I cannot find any other.
Well, here's the problem. Like, now we're into that warning watch thing, like we are with tornadoes and thunderstorms, sure. Where nobody can ever figure out which is
right. Are we watching it? Is it a warning? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess at least it'll be consistent now, so maybe people will.
Right.
Figure it out, but...
A watch is potential. A warning is happening.
But yeah, I mean, I always kind of thought below zero was kind of a funny thing because 32 degrees is freezing, so...
Right, it's...
Like zero, right. Zero, like...
I'm sure that goes to the Celsius scale, Matt. You know what I mean? Right. The term is from the... But
I mean, right. what do you... What we were learning in school, like, you know, zero and negatives or whatever, like... Well, no, shouldn't zero be the bottom? Like, shouldn't be that as cold as it gets?
32 is the bottom.
Like, nope, no, we can go in the negatives. Like, why okay. Anyway.
Can it be less than zero? What?
Yes, we can go upside down.
Do you think they'll mess with the heat index now and retire that? Like, that was the equivalent.
Yeah.
It's possible.
That they set, you know, this was.
So a year from now, we'll be doing a. Spotlight on the heat warning.
They'll call it
heat advice. Well, they already kind of do heat advice,
right? I think that one probably. And the word index is different than wind. You know, wind, like right. You say, people are like, oh, if it's not windy, then I'm not going to die out here. Right. It's really cold.
Nope, it's still 35 below.
And if we were in Siberia, it wouldn't matter till like negative 50. So it's all good. All right, now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So since we're talking wind chill, let's continue that discussion and look at where that whole thing even came from. So wind chill is the term used to describe the rate of heat loss from the human body resulting from combined effect of low temperature and wind. As winds increase, heat is carried away from the body at a faster rate, driving down both skin temperature and eventually the internal body temperature. The old wind chill, or WCT, formula was introduced by Antarctic explorer Paul A. Sipple in his 1939 dissertation, Adaptation of the Explorer to the Climate of Antarctica. During the 1940s, Sipple, who coined the term wind chill, and Charles F. Passel experimented with measuring the time it took to freeze 250 grams of water in different temperature and wind conditions. They developed empirical formulas relating to that data to the rate of heat loss from exposed human skin. The new WCT formula makes use of advances in science, technology, and computer modeling to provide a more accurate, understandable, and useful formula for calculating the dangers from wind and freezing temperatures. In addition, clinical trials have been conducted, and the results of those trials have been used to verify and improve the accuracy of the new formula. So, and like they said in the article, they are still using wind chill, just using it internally. They're not going to
give us a wind chill.
Tell the people, yeah, your wind chill is at whatever. It's like, okay, it's going to be negative 20 or below. Basically negative 20 to 30.
It's baked in the advisory. Right. Baked in the warning.
Do you think they'll just use the word real? In real hot, feel? They say, well, real feel
isn't
is,
that.
That's like those
NBC
weather
26.
Apps. Yeah, thing, no, yeah, I think you're right. Cameron Moreland, you're right. He's like.
Your real feel temperature.
Yeah, when he gives you his 3-degree guarantee, he also tells what it'll actually feel like. So I almost feel like they'll probably just replace it with that term as well.
Right.
It'll be like, this is what it feels like when it's cold and that windy.
Because, I mean, you could always argue, like, which is more important, the real feel or the actual air temperature. And in the case of wind chill, it'd be the real feel because it doesn't matter that it's only 10 degrees below zero.
Yeah.
It's the fact that with the wind, it's going to act like it's 30 degrees below zero or whatever it is.
Right.
So. But anyway. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It is real easy. All you need to do is search Tilth Talk Radio on your iPhone in Apple Podcasts. Or on your Android phone, download an app like Podcast Addict, and there too search Tilth Talk Radio. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthegg.com/podcasts, and you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll do our Cool Beans, That's Corny, and some current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. Farmers are looking to weeding robots as a herbicides-resistant solution. So a new survey by the Illinois Center for Digital Agriculture.
Illinois sounds like a cool new word. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it's that place to the south. Finds more than half of corn farmers would adopt weeding robots. Ag economist Shedai Atala says the prevalence of herbicide-resistant weeds is a major factor. Looked at two situations, a $40,000 robot and a $20,000 robot. And as you would imagine, the more expensive the robot, the more I'm going to wait until I have more weeds and more resistance until I adopt it. More than 93% of planted row crops in the U.S. have genetically modified herbicide resistance, but Atala says the efficacy is declining. Some studies have shown that if we don't have any alternative and we keep losing the efficacy of chemical control, it's going to lead to crop losses that can reach up to $100 billion per year. So,
I feel like Elon's in some, like, he's in his back pocket, like, oh,
well, that's
a weeding robot.
It's what he does, is just buys into technology that other people come up with, is most of his thing. So, I'm sure
he's worried about going to Mars right now.
Oh,
He's probably more worried about the fact that insurance companies are dropping the Cybertruck, but.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's not good. I seen one of those out in the wild.
There's a couple around here.
Yeah, and I was like, and one my wife was riding with, and she's like, what is that thing? And I'm like, that's a cyber, you know.
It looks like something out of RoboCop.
The weirdest one I saw was up in Cribbets. There was a black one.
Ooh, cool.
Like, it wasn't the silver. Yeah. Like what most of them are. It was painted black, so. But anyway.
How do you think farmers would if we show up with cyber trucks?
Probably laugh at us.
Yeah, they'd be like, what the heck?
Plus, they're pretty expensive, so.
Right.
They would wonder if they're paying us too much if we showed up in a cyber truck. And you can't mount a machine gun on it, apparently. This guy tried to do that.
You can on a regular truck?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, so it's a whole nother thing. We're not going to do that. But anyway, we'll talk about it after the podcast.
Are we Libyan terrorists?
It was a Russian. But anyway, weed robots may be the stopgap, at least the potential for having something that isn't going to, you know, chemical resistance won't matter if it either pulls the weed or imagine electricity killing it.
Lasers.
Maybe an option. So maybe something we see more of in the future. I know they're the advances in robotics and in drones and everything is just keeps happening at a more rapid pace. So it could be something we see sooner rather than later. Our That's Corny this week is dual hurricanes deliver a 1-2 punch to Florida phosphate production. So Helene obviously went through a couple weeks ago, did damage to Florida, Tennessee, North Carolina in particular, the Asheville area. And now Milton has passed through that Florida area, going from Sarasota to the other side of the state. And so both Helene and Milton have caused issues with phosphate production in Florida. StoneX Vice President of Fertilizer Josh Linville says the phosphate market has been hit back-to-back. Helene was more of a glancing blow, but it kind of touched the west coast of Florida on its way up to ravage the southeastern U.S., but Milton was a direct shot. It was kind of the absolute worst-case scenario for Western Florida, and the problem with that is the phosphate market. He says that a tremendous amount of U.S. phosphate is produced in Florida, more specifically nearby Tampa Bay. And so we're sitting, the hurricane has gone through, and now we're waiting with bated breath to see how much damage there is, not only to facilities, but obviously workers, homes, friends that need to be cleaned up before everyone can get back to work. So the downtime will negatively affect phosphate production, and farmers intending to apply fall fertilizer should plan for price volatility and issues with supply. So thanks, Milton and Helene. Never, just sounds like a couple that you wouldn't want to invite to your
Milton
house.
And
Milton
Helene.
And Helene.
I believe you said I could listen to my music at a reasonable volume.
I have no longer been receiving my paycheck. Yeah, it shows you don't work here anymore. I will burn this place to the ground. In case you haven't seen Office Space, Milton's an important character in that movie. So, all right, now we'll wrap things up with our Feel Good Friday. The World Forage Analysis Super Bowl winners have been announced and honored for this year. So, a total of 207 entries from 12 states were evaluated at this year's World Forage Analysis Super Bowl. And Meadowbrook's Dairy of Manitowoc, Wisconsin was a first-time entrant in the contest and was named Grand Champion Forage Producer with its BMR silage entry. A number of local farms were involved here, so they have different categories. They've got baleage, commercial hay, dairy hay, grass hay, alfalfa haylage, mixed grass haylage, standard corn silage, BMR silage. Horson's Homestead was the BMR silage top. And from Cecil, Wisconsin, Seven Oaks Dairy from Kaukauna was the number two in the mixed grass haylage category.
Number one in the state.
They were number one in the state.
Yeah, the number one was from Michigan.
Ah, yes. I see that. Yep. So the top in the state for Wisconsin. Then we've also got a few other local ones, or Wisconsin. Winners, you got some from Grand Marsh and Oxford, Wisconsin, Rosedale Farms and Church Farms for grass hay. Also, not even going to try to pronounce that one, from Thorpe, Wisconsin. That was the top winner in the grass hay production. Then Nettleman Farms in Bangor, Wisconsin was top for baleage.
We had a top five was all,
yeah,
Wisconsin,
all Wisconsin
baleage.
For baleage. Yep.
But the commercial hay... No winners.
Yeah. Top really? Three were so Wyoming.
Wyoming.
And then North Carolina and Oklahoma. Dairy hay was split between Indiana, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Then, let's see, Greenwood, Pine Court Farm in Greenwood was number two in alfalfa haylage for top in Wisconsin. And number five in alfalfa haylage was also from Wisconsin, Golden Ridge Dairy and Crivets. Yeah, mixed grass haylage was all Wisconsin except for the top one from Michigan. Standard corn silage was a mix. Had Denmar Acres and from Greenleaf and Olson Farms from Lena were in the standard corn silage mix, along with Michigan, Indiana, and Minnesota. And then, like we said, Horson's Homestead took the top spot with BMR corn silage, Vanderlinden Farms from Greenleaf, Wayside Dairy from Greenleaf, and Hornstead Dairy from Brilliant kind of finished out that category too. So a lot of good local farms recognized in the Forage Super Bowl. So congratulations to them. That'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So today we talk compaction, how you can test for it when it's kind of the right time to test for it, and things you can do to help alleviate it. In our spotlight, we took a look at the National Weather Service no longer issuing wind chill warnings and advisory. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of the wind chill and where that term came from. Cool beans this week. Farmers may look to weeding robots to handle herbicide resistance. That's corny. The two hurricanes, Helene and Milton, have delivered a 1-2 punch to Florida phosphate production. And our Field Good Friday was World Forage Analysis Super Bowl winners have been honored. So thanks for listening. And as always, happy farming.